And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And we're going to start back into a commentary that we started a couple of weeks ago before the Thanksgiving break. This is a commentary on the Earth First Journal, and it's entitled Radical Evolution. Earth First Journal celebrates 20 years, and this is from the Eugene Weekly of November 2nd. And we're starting about a third of the way into it on a paragraph entitled The Legacy Gene. Many people on the radical edge in Eugene acknowledge that the journal's presence has had a profound effect on activism here. It's helped build the community, purveys for activism, and started a wave that's grown and evolved over the years the paper has been published here. After the move to Oregon, Earth Firsters began pouring into Eugene. First came the four long-term editors, all newcomers to the city. Some came with partners or groups of friends. The structure of the staff included spots for one or two short-term editors every 6 weeks, which in turn brought activists from around the country to learn newspaper skills and share ideas and information and strategy. Many of these people stayed and in turn brought more people as the borders between bioregions dissolved in the face of intriguing campaigns or love affairs. The journal helped make Eugene a magnet. For a very long time, the Earth First community was a very small, tight-knit group that at any given time had a core group of less than a dozen, Juliana said of the pre-journal days. Even though we had a local office, we had the ability to call upon a larger group. The core group was very small. That's definitely changed over the years. The core group, I'd say now, would be in the 30s or 40s. Eugene's location, many say, deserves a fair bit of the credit. Its proximity to outdoor recreation wilderness, things Earth First was established to defend, and its accessibility to activist hubs in California and Washington made it a natural stopping place for activists on the road. But the journal provided a center, a meeting point, a crash pad, and a place to plug in to local campaigns and keep abreast of news from other bioregions. Mailing parties offered a regular gathering that allowed the community and people passing through town to connect. Quote, Eugene being a transient town because of the university, having the journal here has given a sense of stability and continuity to the local forest defense community, Juliana said. The influx of people helped spark an activist evolution. Quote, I think that the journal can at least take partial credit or partial blame depending on how you look at it. I look at it as credit for Eugene's reputation now, this whole Eugene anarchist thing, says John Green, one of the first four long-term editors here. Quote, a lot of it is an outgrowth of things that started when the journal moved to Eugene. Others say that connection isn't quite as direct, but the evolutionary trend seems clear. The journal and Earth First generally created a sense of community that fostered the development of different activist forms. Quote, having a radical community is one way of keeping the powers that be honest or trying to keep them honest and not let them get away with anything, Green says. And if those voices weren't out there, there wouldn't be press to change things that need to be changed, unquote. Randy Shadowwalker, a Eugene native and co-producer of the activist cable access television show Cascadia Alive, is part of the activist evolution. At several discrete points, says Shadowwalker, new people came in to add energy and shift the direction of that activism. The end result is something bigger and substantially different than what came before. 2 years after the journal arrived, the blockade at Warner Creek brought new activists like Shadowwalker into the field, although not all considered themselves Earth Firsters. After four women were arrested as the Forest Service broke up the Warner Creek encampment days before the sale was canceled, the activists trying to get into their arraignment rioted when denied access, bringing that blockade spirit into town. The clear confluence between Earth First energy from the woods and the black-clad anarchists in the city came on June 1, 1997, nearly a year after the jailhouse riot. The city wanted to clear out trees on Broadway between Charlton and Lincoln. The activists wouldn't let the trees go down without a fight. While activists, including the entire journal staff at the time, were sitting in trees or standing nearby facing pepper spray and tear gas, Shadowwalker says the black bloc that 2 years later gained political notoriety during the WTO protests in Seattle made its first move, a small outburst of breaking windows in downtown Eugene. Shadowwalker says the black bloc action of the day was definitely about the logging. It was just a different form of protest than traditional Earth First. Green, the former editor, calls the June 1st action a watershed event in Eugene history. It's one of the first times police brutality was really made into an issue. It certainly has the city thinking twice before they even discuss cutting trees down. So there's a joining of two foci or two issues in the community, environmental issues and police brutality, all rolled up into one. This summer, another group at the Round River Rendezvous decided it was time for the Journal to move again. Next spring, the paper will move back to its birthplace in Tucson. Doug Scholkopf, a long-term editor who will follow the paper to Arizona, explained that the move was prompted by Earth Firsters with new energy to put into the paper and a vision of using the journal to bring together activists working on Native American issues and border issues like globalization and NAFTA. Tucson, with its diverse ethnic communities and its location near the Mexican border, offered a unique opportunity to bring in new blood and address issues of growing concern to environmentalists. Mick Garvin, chairman of the local Sierra Club group and spokesman to the media in the early days of Warner Creek, followed the journal into Oregon with his friend Craig Benneville, joined the original editorial collective here. Now well ensconced in the community, Garvin doesn't believe activism will lessen in the journal's absence. Quote, I think the activist community achieved critical mass sometime 4 or 5 years ago and will continue to draw new energy in by its reputation and its activities without the journal's presence, he says. The journal's presence will be missed, but I think Eugene's developed the largest community per capita of activists that I've ever seen. Unquote. People now hear about Eugene not because of Earth First Journal, he says, but because of Red Cloud Thunder, those tree sitters at the Clark Timber Sale along Fall Creek, and because of conflicts between protesters and police. Juliana, who remembers the days when radical activism was a smaller part of Eugene, sees the move as a mixed bag for Eugene. What's going to happen when the journal leaves? I think a lot of people will stay and a lot of people will drift on. He hopes we'll leave a, quote, smaller group with more energy for actually doing forest defense again, where people have been focusing their energy on putting out the paper, can now go back to focusing on timber sales. If there's a functional equivalent to the Earth First Journal mailing party for more recent activist evolution in town, it's the weekly gathering at Tiny Tavern. Every week, a wide variety of activists gets together ostensibly to watch Cascadia live, drink microbrew pints, and have intense political debates at the bar, or just hang with friends in a booth. The place is packed, dark, and smoky. The television goes off just after 10 p.m. and a loud bang goes on. On a cold, clear, I'll sit on the green AstroTurf steps sharing cigarettes. It's a younger crowd than at the journal mailing party, although the ages range up into the 40s or 50s. Two people mill through the crowd handing out a new class schedules for the free school, still warm from the photocopy machine. This isn't specifically Earth First territory, although there are Earth Firsters in the mix. In the bar, you see little of the all-black clothing that's become media shorthand for describing the anarchist contingent. The people at Tiny's are here for each other, not for police or television cameras. Stinkweed, a woman handing out free school schedules, says that while she puts the Earth First, she has never felt fully part of the Earth First crowd. Its culture is too male-oriented, she says, based on the model of a heroic 60s action figure. She thinks Eugene better without the journal, which she says distracts people from getting out into the streets or into the woods doing actions. Earth First Day is done, she says. People are leapfrogging over that, she says. Earth First pushed it this far. Anarchists are going to push it the next leap. Creative feminist culture, which she says is growing in town, will push debate and action further still. Shelley Kidder has lived in Eugene twice as long as the journal has been here. Her green-hooded sweatshirt looks back at the dark of the parking lot where she smokes. They're sensationalizing already, she says when asked if the city is black. She does credit to the journal's time in Eugene with increasing activism here, providing a center for other activities to swirl around. Like Stinkweed, Kidder believes that people who have dedicated their time to the journal will join the front lines with a pickaxe in their hand when the newspaper leaves. Just before the Earth First Journal's 20th birthday, on Halloween, Kidder's activist prayer for the next decades also illuminates the importance of the first two. Quote, I hope it continues to carry the radical torch for the whole movement, she says, because it's high time we stop the destruction of the planet. By any means necessary. Amen. And that's been our editorial, written by Orna Isaacson in two parts, from the Eugene Weekly of November 2nd. And we're going to move into regular old news here. A powerful national coalition of religious, scientific, and environmental groups charging hypocrisy on the part of the Clinton administration has strongly attacked an order from the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service refusing to give any further protection to most species facing extinction for the next 10 months. The order signed by Fish and Wildlife Service Director Jamie Rappaport-Clark directed all agency staff to, quote, immediately stop work on any endangered species listing actions not under court order or settlement agreement, unquote, claiming that the agency did not have the funds to do the required work. Listing refers to an official evaluation of scientific data about the status on imperiled species' ecological health necessary before a species can be placed on the endangered list under the terms of the Endangered Species Act. Once listed, that species is entitled to a full range of federal protections. Quote, this said the very agency which is supposed to be the guardian of our country's wildlife could amount to a death warrant for the 25 species now awaiting their chance of rescue, said Brock Evans, executive director of the Species Coalition. An angry Evans observing that Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt has since 1997 deliberately and intentionally requested the Congress to not give them sufficient funds to list species, asserted that the agency can then claim lack of funding is, quote, hypocrisy on a grand scale, and it is because they are mad at environmentalists for getting court orders to make them do what they don't want to do, even though the law absolutely requires them to do it. Evans was referring to a series of court orders obtained by environmental groups over the past 4 years directing the agency to designate areas of critical habitat as required by law for species already listed. The agency claims that such designations are unnecessary. Environmentalists and scientists strongly disagree, saying that wildlife can't survive without protected habitat. They're playing a deadly political game almost out of spite, it seems, said Evans. And it is our endangered wild creatures who can't vote or fight back who will be the losers. We invite the Clinton administration to join with us and seek emergency funding in the upcoming lame duck session of Congress instead of seeking scapegoats and risking loss of our heritage. Who knows? Washington is a strange place these days. And after 5 years of litigation, a federal judge has ruled that the National Marine Fisheries Service must reconsider its decision not to list some species of steelhead fish as threatened. Judge Susan Alston ruled that the agency's decision not to list steelhead populations in Northern California and Southern Oregon as threatened under the Endangered Species Act was, quote, arbitrary and capricious and therefore illegal. The agency must now make a new decision, quote, consistent with, unquote, the court's decision no later than March 1st of 2001. Various environmental groups and commercial and sport fishing organizations represented by the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund have been suing the National Marine Fisheries Service since 1995 to compel the agency to protect declining West Coast steelhead populations in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and California. Steelhead have been in decline due to the loss of their freshwater spawning and rearing habitat. Logging dams, water diversions for irrigation, and water pollution have all contributed to habitat loss. In March of 1998, the National Marine Fisheries Service decided that listing the Klamath Mountains Province population of steelhead was not warranted because the states of Oregon and California and the federal government had all proposed conservation measures for the fish. The environmental and fishing groups disagreed. Judge Alston sided with the group, saying that the state plans do not reduce or eliminate the threats to steelhead in this region enough to eliminate the need to list them under the Endangered Species Act. Promises of future action should not preclude a listing decision, Alston said, because, quote, there are no assurances that the measures will be carried out, when they will be carried out, nor whether they will be effective in eliminating the threats to the species. And President Bill Clinton has signed the Great Ape Conservation Act of 2000, H.R. 4320, pledging financial and scientific assistance for protecting the great apes of the world. The bill will provide funding for conservation programs designed to protect chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans. The bill authorizes $5 million annually in U.S. support to aid conservation and protection of the great apes by allocating grants to local wildlife management authorities and other organizations in Africa and Asia dedicated to protecting the apes and their habitat. Great apes are imperiled around the world due to habitat destruction and hunting for the bushmeat trade. Logging operations destroy habitat and allow hunters access to pristine sections of forest. And a petition seeking to remove endangered wildland caribou from federal protection under the Endangered Species Act does not present scientific evidence to warrant delisting, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced. The agency received the delisting from the Great Bonners Ferry Chamber of Commerce in May of 1998. The petitioners claimed the original listing in 1984 was based on conjecture and inadequate research with no biological reason or need for the listing, We don't find any scientific reason to consider delisting this species, said Ann Badgley, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Pacific Regional Director. While it is true there is much to learn about the caribou, the service has enough information to establish the caribou's listing is warranted, including substantial information about habitat fragmentation and other threats to the species. And after years of study, negotiations, and compromise, the world's biggest wetlands restoration project is finally ready for launch. The U.S. House of Representatives voted to approve legislation funding the first portion of the $7.8 billion restoration of the Florida Everglades. The $1.4 billion down payment for Everglades restoration was approved after the Senate led the way by approving the bill earlier. The bill passed as part of the larger Water Resources and Development Act and is expected to be signed by Bill Clinton after the elections, which are still going on, I guess. Led by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the restoration effort will attempt to reverse some of the misguided replumbing of the Everglades that straightened channels, diked marshes, and dramatically altered the flow of fresh water through the nation's largest wetlands. And defenders of wildlife have formally petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reintroduce wolves into the southern Rocky Mountains, an area encompassing western Colorado, southern Wyoming, northern New Mexico, and Arizona, and parts of Utah. The region would be ideal for wolves because it is sparsely populated and contains large stretches of public land, said Defenders Vice President Bob Ferris. After most wolves in the lower 48 states were killed off in the early 1900s, the federal government reintroduced gray wolves into Yellowstone and Soho in 1995, and wolf populations there are now thriving. And the fragile orange and black butterfly has won habitat protection from a strong conservation organizations, local community, and the Mexican government. Recently, Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo officially decreed the new monarch butterfly biosphere reserve to protect more of the Oyamel, that is balsam fir forest, where the monarchs live during the winter months. The newly protected area will connect the current butterfly sanctuaries within the forest with a linking corridor. The decree will implement the system through which local people will be financially compensated for their lost logging rights in the preserve. And this all came as part of a $5 million grant from the Packard Foundation. And ministers from South Africa, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe have signed an agreement on to take down fences and create the largest wildlife park in the world with one of the longest names, the Gaza-Kruger-Gonarezu Transfrontier Park, will link three existing preserves in three countries and cover 13,500 square miles. The new park will expand the habitat range for wildlife, especially elephants, whose population in South Africa's Kruger National Park are at capacity. The ministers hope it will also boost tourism and local economies. The agreement still has some wrinkles to be ironed out relating to problems in the parks in Mozambique and Zimbabwe, such as poaching, illegal logging, and landmines. And a study in Brazil says that a plan to repair and build four major roads could harm more than one-third of the country's Amazon forest over the next 20 years. Work on the roads in four states, totaling 3,500 kilometers, is part of a $40 million economic program known as Advance Brazil. The study claims the program could destroy between 28 and 42% of the forest's 4 million square kilometers. Researchers fear that once the work is finished, the roads will provide easy access by loggers and ranchers to a swath of untouched vegetation, especially in the southern and eastern parts of the forest, thereby speeding up deforestation. And a brand of canned tuna that may not be dolphin-friendly is being sold in U.S. supermarkets throughout California, concludes the investigation conducted by Earth Island Institute's International Marine Mammal Project. The Dolores brand tuna, which is manufactured in Mexico, carries a label stating Amigo del Delfin, Spanish for dolphin-friendly, but the Earth Island Institute says the company has chased, netted, and killed dolphins in purse seine nets to catch tuna for its product. U.S. federal law prohibits the use of dolphin-safe or dolphin-friendly labels for tuna caught by that fishing method, which has led to the deaths of more than 7 million dolphins over the past four decades. Earth Island has forwarded the findings to the Federal Trade Commission, which enforces the International Dolphin Conservation Program Act's dolphin-safe labeling requirements, as well as to the U.S. Customs Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the Food and Drug Administration. Under federal law, tuna sold as dolphin safe or dolphin friendly must be caught without encircling, killing, or seriously injuring any dolphins by the deadly purse seine nets during the entire fishing trip. Dolores brand tuna is canned by the tuna giant Pinza. Pinza processes 50 to 60% of Mexico's canned tuna and has advocated weakening the dolphin safe labeling requirements. As many as 5 million cans of Dolores brand tuna may have been smuggled into the U.S. this year alone for distribution in Mexican specialty food stores around the U.S. And as environment ministers prepare for a major climate change conference in The Hague, scientists in Britain's Hadley Center for Climate Prediction and Research said planting forests to absorb carbon dioxide and reduce global warming could be counterproductive. Two studies published in the science journal Nature using computer models of global warming show that as temperatures rise, forests or so-called carbon sinks are likely to emit more CO2 into the forest, leading to further warming of the climate. The findings could have important implications for the Hague meeting, because the use of carbon sinks is one of the key issues that were debated during that two-week conference. And I wanted to read this about the studies. The second study, even though the conference has ended at this point, the second study by Dr. Richard Betts also showed that planting new forests in cold parts of the world like Siberia and Canada could do more harm than good, because in northern countries where the ground is covered with snow, forests absorb more of the sun's heat than the terrain. The additional exposure to the sun has a warming influence that could offset part of the cooling effect of the CO2 uptake. And voters in Alaska rejected an attempt to pass a constitutional amendment to ban wildlife initiatives backed by the Coalition for the Alaskan Way of Life. A group of hunters and rural natives, Measure 1 failed after gaining only 36% of the statewide vote. Conservation groups and other opponents said this measure was an attack on both the initiative process and wildlife and would impede citizens' voting rights. CALL members who viewed the measure as a way to stop attacks on hunting and trapping claimed they lost because opponents of the measure successfully portrayed it as an attempt to rob Alaskans of their right to vote. In a closer contest, voters passed a measure to renew the ban on land and shoot hunting of wolves by 53% to 47%. And America's coasts and ocean waters gained renewed protections when President Bill Clinton signed two bills reauthorizing the nation's prime laws governing ocean conservation. The two measures, the National Marine Sanctuaries Amendments Act of 2000 and the Coastal Barrier Resources Reauthorization Act, will provide $220 million over the next 5 years to protect and manage the nation's marine sanctuaries and barrier islands. The Reauthorization Act increases funding for the management of the 13 existing sanctuaries and creates new goals for the program. Five of those marine sanctuaries were added in the past 8 years by the Clinton-Gore administration. And that is five times the funding these areas enjoyed before President Clinton took office 8 years ago. And that's about all the time we have for news right now. To get your news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, you can send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com, that's cruzef@cruzio.com, or you can send regular letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, and be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address until next spring is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that address is Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440, and the first issue is free. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You can go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. I think you'll get redirected to the right place. You can also go look at live365.com and search on FRSC. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so tune in anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. And you'll need an MP3 player, which is free on that website. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Be sure to ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of our intern Stefan and Eon Blues. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to some more of Robert Hoyt's new CD, Mind's Eye, and this one's called Swamp.
So you people think you've been in some mighty wild places, high mountain tops and in wide open spaces. I don't care where you choose to romp, but you ain't seen nothing till you've been in the swamp. Where the black bear frolics and the barred owl talks, some people say that the panther still walks. Watch out for your kids, watch out for your dog. Don't step there, that ain't no log. Swamp, swamp, the swamp is alive. Swamp, swamp, will you survive? Listen to the frogs and listen to your fear. It says a city living human ain't got no business here. Well, a cottonmouth moccasin comes swimming by you. The stories I've heard, well, I hope they aren't true. To die in the swamp ain't no crime. The mosquitoes haul you off and drop them blood at a time. Swamp, swamp, the swamp is alive. Swamp, swamp, will you survive? You think you're gonna live, then you know you're gonna die. Cause the wild pig is staring you right straight in the eye. For mercy you beg, cause there's a snake up in the trees, bigger round as your leg.